From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, two writers. One left New York to find a new self. The other went to New York to work among the literary elite. We'll talk with poet James Merrill about his new memoir, A Different Self, about how he set sail for Europe in 1950, hoping to put an ocean between himself and everything he'd known. Merrill's memoir is also about what it was like to grow up wealthy. His father co-founded Merrill Lynch. And Willie Morris will talk with us about his recent memoir, New York Days, about the years he was the editor-in-chief at Harper's. We have another writer on the show, Doug Roberto Gilb, but until recently, few people knew he wrote. He made his living as a construction worker. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles tells us about the new and improved Mexican rock and roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Jurors in the Reginald Denny beating trial rendered partial verdicts today, acquitting the two defendants of some of the more serious charges, but convicting them on others. The jury's been sent home to rest before returning to deliberate on two remaining counts. Henry Watson was acquitted of attempted murder, but convicted on a single charge of misdemeanor assault. Damian Williams was acquitted of several serious charges, but convicted of several counts of misdemeanor assault and one count of simple mayhem. Hours after the first verdicts were read, the panel came back to render a not guilty verdict in a robbery charge against Williams. The jury said it's still deadlocked 11-1 on an attempted murder count against Williams. The people gathered outside the courthouse in Los Angeles were generally pleased with the verdicts announced today. Greg Lamphere of KLON prepared this report.
Chants from supporters calling for the immediate release of the two defendants erupted after all the verdicts were read. Many said any guilty verdict is a sham. Several of Damian Williams' friends say they are glad he got off on some of the most serious charges. Reverend Andrew Robinson Gaither of the Faith United Methodist Church in South Los Angeles says the LA Four were just targets of an unfair justice system.
These brothers have been scapegoats from the very beginning. And as a pastor, I want to always challenge the American system in any way that I can to say, let's be fair, let's be equitable. There has been some justice, not what I anticipated, but a level of justice.
Police have beefed up patrols on the streets of Los Angeles, but say they are not expecting a violent reaction to the verdicts. For National Public Radio, I'm Greg Lamphere in Los Angeles.
A left-wing German terrorist has been convicted of attempted murder for helping with a car bombing at a U.S. airbase in Germany in the ambush of an American general. Deirdre Berger reports.
A court in Stuttgart has sentenced 39-year-old Ingrid Jakobsmeyer to 15 years in prison for participation in two terrorist attacks. The bombing attack at Ramstein Air Base in August 1981 injured 17 people. Four more people were hurt 2 weeks later when Red Army faction terrorists in Heidelberg shot at the car of a U.S. general. Prosecutors had no concrete evidence of Jakobsmeyer participation. The conviction was based primarily on testimony of another former Red Army faction activist. Jakobsmeyer is just completing a 9-year prison sentence for membership in the outlawed Red Army faction. She now must serve another 6 years. The federal prosecutor had asked for life in prison, but the judge said he decided on a lower sentence because Jakobsmeyer has renounced the use of violence to achieve political aims. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 13 points to close at 3,642. This is NPR. Government scientists say the ozone hole over the Antarctic is slightly smaller than it was last year, but overall ozone levels are at a record low. Ozone is a thin layer of the atmosphere that prevents much of the sun's harmful ultraviolet radiation from reaching the Earth. Scientists have become increasingly concerned about ozone depletion since the discovery of a hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica. Although the hole was slightly smaller this year, scientists said the actual amount of ozone over the South Pole was smaller than it's ever been. A federal judge has ruled that Oklahoma must return a convicted murderer to New York State to serve a prison sentence before it can execute him. Steve Carmody of member station KGOU reports from Oklahoma City.
In Muskogee this afternoon, federal judge Frank C. ordered the state of Oklahoma to return convicted killer Thomas Grasso to New York. Grasso was scheduled to die by lethal injection just after midnight tonight. but the federal judge agreed with New York State attorneys that under the interstate extradition agreement that brought Grasso to Oklahoma to stand trial for a 1990 murder, he must be returned to New York to serve a 20-year sentence for murder there first. Oklahoma officials have tried to convince New York Governor Mario Cuomo to waive his state's rights to hold Grasso, but Cuomo maintains he does not have the authority to do so. Grasso has not fought his death sentence, insisting he prefers death to life in prison. Oklahoma Governor David Walters admits this appears to be the end of the road legally, but he will meet with his attorney general to explore other options. For National Public Radio, this is Steve Carmody.
One of the nation's TV rating services has fallen victim to bad ratings itself. Ceridian Corporation says it will end its money-losing Arbitron television rating service and lay off 700 employees. The company plans to focus on its profitable radio rating service. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the age of 32, Willie Morris became the youngest editor-in-chief of the oldest magazine in America, Harper's. Under Morris's leadership, Harper's became a hot magazine. In his ambition to remake literary America, Morris brought on such writers as Norman Mailer, David Halberstam, William Styron, and Arthur Miller. Morris resigned under pressure in 1971. His new memoir about his years at Harper's is called New York Days. Morris came to New York in 1963 to become a junior editor of the magazine. He grew up in Mississippi, which is the subject of his first memoir, North Toward Home. He now lives in Jackson, Mississippi. He told me what Harper's was like when he took it over.
It's the oldest magazine in America, still is, with a noteworthy tradition. But I felt it had become somewhat arid and perhaps even a little smug. It was publishing a lot of pieces by diet faddists, by retired professors, writing quaint travel pieces, by retired diplomats, a little self-satisfied, and I didn't think it was reflecting in any important degree what was going on in America.
How old were you when you became the editor?
Well, let's see. I was 32.
That's very young to be the editor of a national magazine.
Well, I never thought of it in that way. I guess we were so busy putting out a magazine that we considered important. I always told people when they asked me how did it feel to be so young to be running the oldest magazine in the country, I said, well, by the age of 32, most of the baseball players have already hung up the spikes. It was then and still is a young person's profession, I think, as it should be.
When you took over Harper's, the magazine was about $125,000 to $150,000 in debt annually.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you as an editor? Did you see it as your job to turn that around and get the magazine in the red? Or did you consider the financial straits of the magazine secondary to its literary quality?
We had a mandate from the owners to really pull out all the stops over about a five-year period, not to worry too much about that deficit, but to bring in the best writers and the journalists and the poets, but with a hardcore of journalism to delve into these pressing issues and to be given the freedom and the space to do so, to revitalize an old enduring institution and let the chips fall where they may.
So you weren't worried about the money, you just wanted to put out something that you thought was good.
Well, our theory was that, you know, if it began to work and with the cooperation of owners, that a deficit could be overcome, although it became a particularly difficult period in magazine publishing. A federal policy on postal rates, increased specialization of other magazines, such as those addressed to doctors who drove Mercedes and liked to ski in Aspen.
Right.
We thought that a boldness and vivid and sturdy writing would carry the day.
Well, did it? I mean, you know, it's not always true that good quality makes for the best sales. I mean, did you feel that by boosting the quality of the magazine, you boosted the circulation? And
well, we went through a Nixon recession, and the magazine had a deficit. And we were really working, went through a lot of transformation. And I finally resigned, along with the rest of the staff, including Halberstam, Dave Halberstam, Larry L. King, and Midge Dector, Prady, and John Corey, and others. When the owners in Minneapolis decided they wanted a more specialized magazine and to use readership polls to determine what readers wanted, which we couldn't go along with that. Another alternative was to cut back drastically on circulation.
What would that have accomplished?
That would have accomplished cutting down costs, you know, mailing costs and printing costs and all the rest.
How do you cut down circulation? Tell people not to subscribe anymore?
Well, you can control the flow by the size of solicitations and mailings. Also, another alternative was to go ahead and cut the staff in half, and we were putting out a magazine with a very, very small editorial staff. Really, there were only about three of us. Our staff writers were not getting paid the national norm. We'd hired David Halberstam, one of the heroes in American journalism, from the New York Times, that had a salary of about $4,000 or $5,000 more than a copy boy was making in the newsroom of the Times. But the point is that when it became quite clear to me that these were the extreme alternatives, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I mean, someone else could come in and do that magazine, but that person was not I.
So you wrote a letter of resignation. Did you think they were going to accept it?
Well, I kind of figured they were, but there was an off chance that it would jog them a little bit, and it didn't. And the staff walked out. Almost the whole staff walked out, and the owners tried other editors and other approaches. That didn't work until eventually the Coles's sold out to a rather highly conservative private foundation in 1980.
When you were forced out of the magazine, what did it feel like after being so emotionally involved with the magazine, having so much of your identity built upon being the editor of it, and suddenly it's not yours anymore?
It was made me feel very bereft. I in my concluding chapters of New York Days, I tried to describe that sense of loss. Moved out to Eastern Long Island, and I missed, quite frankly, a lot of the perquisites of position, the secretaries and the power and the glamour, the business lunches, and all of a sudden to have that gone. It was a kind of a bleak time in my life. And I was only about, 37 years old, 38 or however much. And remember Bill Moyers reminded me, said, well, you still own a typewriter. And my son, David Ray, whom I was very close to, said, well, let's go to a ball game. It was not the end of life. And continuing bitterness is very, self-destructive, especially for a writer. And I realized in my heart that I was a writer, and that I was going to dedicate the rest of my life to writing, which I have done. And my whole experience as an editor, I think, has helped me immeasurably as a writer. So the bitterness did not last terribly long, but there was a profound sense of loss, and the phone stopped ringing.
Well, let me say something about the phone.
And it was so quiet.
I mean, you write in your book, at the beginning, you write that there were 8 million telephone numbers in Manhattan, and while you were the editor of Harper's, every one of them would have returned your calls.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it wasn't that way after you ceased being the editor of Harper's. I mean, did...
That's right.
Was that a real blow to your ego?
Well, I didn't get 8 million calls. It wasn't so much a blow to one's ego as it was such a turn of events that from clamor and... intense vivacity and activity. All of a sudden, you were in the snows of Eastern Long Island in the winter, in deep silences, and you just had to proceed from there. I sat down and wrote a children's book. First thing I wrote when I got out there.
Do you feel that when you moved south again, when you returned to the south, that there were parts of your personality that came back out that you might have suppressed when you were in New York?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't think I could have written New York Days if I had not returned home and become deeply rooted again in my native soil.
Why not?
It had something to do with the passing of time, really, and of engaging one's own sensibility and memory. The most valuable ally of the writer is memory itself. Memory about all any of us has anyway. And someone remarked the other day, and I thought interesting, that my Northward Home was in many ways a book about the South as seen from the perspective of the North. And now, 25 years later, the sequel to Northward Home, New York Days, is in many ways a book about the North from the perspective of the South. I had to let those 25 years pass before I could do this. A lot of people have been trying to get me to write this book for some time, but I'm glad I waited. Let things percolate in the psyche a little bit more.
Well, why did you have to wait that long? Was part of it to let all the anger pass?
Oh, it wasn't anger. I wasn't angry. Mm-hmm. It was, comprehension. Mm-hmm. Comprehension of one's own memory, really. Mm-hmm. Which I think is universal to all of us, not just to writers. I deliberately tried to write a work of literature and to make some kind of sense in a historical and literary and deeply personal way of important and inflammatory and quintessential years in a young person's life that happened to have involved a great magazine. But in a period in America where everything seemed to be falling apart, although also a lot of things seemed to be coming together. New York Days is an act of memory and of coming to terms with one's memory.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoy this very much.
Willie Morris's new memoir is called New York Days. We'll talk with poet James Merrill after this break. This is Fresh Air. Many of us have wanted to go far away, be utterly transformed by the experience, and return home a different person. Poet James Merrill acted on that impulse when he was 24 in the year 1950. That 2.5-year trip abroad is the subject of his new memoir, A Different Person. Merrill's father was the Merrill of the brokerage firm Merrill Lynch. James Merrill never joined the firm. Instead, he became one of America's most esteemed poets. He's won the Pulitzer Prize, 2 National Book Awards, and an award from the Library of Congress. This is the opening of his new memoir, A Different Person.
Meaning to stay as long as possible, I sailed for Europe. It was March 1950. New York and most of the people I knew had begun to close in. Or to put it differently, I felt that I alone in this or that circle of friends could see no way into the next phase. Indeed, few of my friends would have noticed if the next phase had never begun. They would have gone on meeting for gossipy lunches or drinking together at the San Remo on MacDougall Street, protected from encounters they perhaps desired with other customers by the glittering moat inches deep of their elusive chatter. I loved this unliterary company. It allowed me to feel more serious than I was. Other friends, by getting jobs or entering graduate schools, left me feeling distinctly less so. On the bright side, I had taught for a year at Bard College, 2 hours by car from McDougal Street. My first book of poems had been accepted by the first publisher I sent it to, and I had recently met the love of my life, or so I thought, who promised to join me in Europe in the early summer, by which time we should both have disentangled ourselves from our past and present worlds. Was I ever coming back? Yes, yes, one of these days. But of course I would be a different person then.
I certainly understand the urge to go away and come back a different person. Can you explain your urge to do that?
Well, I felt hemmed in by the expectations that I had encouraged my friends and family to have for me, and it seemed to me that being on my own, not knowing anybody who had preconceived notions of who I was, would give me a chance to be something more, spontaneous, more like the person I hoped to become, more mature.
Let's talk about the person who you were. One of the things that I think defined you to yourself and to other people was that you were born into wealth. Your father mm-hmm. was co-founder of Merrill Lynch, the brokerage firm.
Yeah.
And your father created an unbreakable trust in each of his children's names when you turned five. So, mm-hmm. so you were born into money.
Yes.
What did you like and not like? What were the advantages and disadvantages of growing up with the family name of Merrill?
Well, the advantages, I guess, dawned on me a good deal later, you know, that I did indeed have license to please myself and to follow my own bent. I think my father was disappointed, both in my case and in my half-brothers, that we showed so little interest in entering the firm, working with him. But my half-sister's husband was the ideal younger partner, and he spent many years happy for himself and happy for my father, working for Merrill Lynch before he branched out to something else.
So what was it like for you to go abroad when you were in your 20s to places where the name of Merrill wouldn't mean what it did in America?
Oh, that was a great relief. And I think always the joy of being abroad is that nobody knows who you are. It's not just the name, but anytime in this country that I would meet somebody, they would be able to tell just from the way I spoke the kind of semi-Ivy League upper-class education I'd had. Whereas if I were, say, in Italy, speaking Italian or even speaking English, they wouldn't necessarily leap to that conclusion. This is something only a compatriot can notice and draw conclusions from.
Writer James Merrill is my guest. His new memoir is called A Different Person. Part of the person, you know, you write that you wanted to go away to Europe and come home a different person. Part of the person who you were was defined by the fact that you were homosexual at a time when you didn't say that publicly to many people. Was that anything that you wanted to change by going away? Was that one of the things you wanted to come home and be different?
And be more at home with.
Be more at home with.
Yes.
As opposed to coming home straight instead of...
Oh, it never occurred to me that I'd come home straight, no. Mm-hmm. But it it allowed me to do as I wished without a sense of disapproving friends and family breathing down my neck.
Was there a sense of what it would mean for the family name if people found out?
Well, there was a sense among members of the family, perhaps, notably my mother, but I didn't see it that way. I mean, people back then were mainly frightened that you would become a security risk and that you would become unemployable if you were gay. Well, I was not going to work for the government, and I was not going to have that kind of job, a corporation job even. And it struck me very gradually that if you don't make any secrets of your life, you're not going to be blackmailed. What would be the point? You know, a perfect openness, a perfect lack of secrecy, allows you to hold up your head, I think.
Well, you couldn't really practice, though, having a lack of secrecy. Your mother said it would kill your father if he found out you were gay. So did you ever speak to him about that?
I never spoke to him about it, but I heard that he had, in fact, found out long before. But he was a man of the world enough to take it in his stride.
Mm-hmm.
He consulted a couple of doctors, said, "Is there anything I can do about this situation?" The doctor said, "No, there isn't." And he took their advice. So I'm full of gratitude for his forbearance, for his, you know, he continued to love me, but it was never an issue.
Because you were born into money, did anybody ever not take you as seriously as you'd like? You know, some people might assume, well, it's easy for him to write. After all, he's never had to hold a job.
Yes, that's a very common idea. I have a delightful nephew, my brother's oldest son, Bruce, who said he was talking to somebody and who said, "I didn't get your name." And Bruce said, my name is Bruce Merrill." "Oh," said the friend, "any relation to the poet instead of any relation to the stockbroker?" And Bruce said, this impressed me very much, "Uncle James, you have won the Oedipal battle."
But did people take you less seriously for a while? You were born with a silver spoon in your mouth, so you had it easy.
Well, it was a view I shared. You know, how can I amount to anything if I haven't had to struggle more? So I arranged probably to struggle in exactly the arena of sexuality and looking for happiness in love. These, to me, were the contests, the agons that in my father's case would have been success in business.
Poet James Merrill, his new memoir is called A Different Person. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, stories of working-class Chicanos. Dagoberto Gilb earned his living as a construction worker for many years. His new book, The Magic of Blood, is a collection of short stories about construction workers and other working-class and out-of-work people. One critic said Gilb's realism is the most lethal kind of fiction a Chicano can write. Also, world music critic Milo Miles tells us about some new Mexican rock and roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Most of the verdicts are in the trial of two men accused of attacking trucker Reginald Denny and seven others at the beginning of last year's Los Angeles riots. NPR's Renee Montaigne has more from the courthouse.
The jurors have deadlocked on two counts, attempted murder and felony assault. The judge has dismissed them for the night in hopes that they will be able to reach a decision on those two counts tomorrow. The jury did convict defendants Damian Williams and Henry Watson on a total of five misdemeanor assaults, and in Williams' case, a felony mayhem count for doing permanent physical damage to Reginald Denny. Prosecutors say Williams is the man caught on videotape smashing the truck driver in the head with a brick. But the jury has deadlocked on whether Williams attempted to murder Denny, and they found the defendants not guilty on the other most serious charges. So far, a big victory for the defense, say defense lawyers. The assistant district attorneys who prosecuted the case are holding comments until the jury comes back with verdicts on the last two counts or declares itself deadlocked. At the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse, I'm Renee Montaigne.
President Clinton has ordered the freezing of assets in the United States that are owned by Haitian leaders blocking democracy. An official of the Treasury Department says the order affects 40 to 50 people and potentially millions of dollars. Senate Republican leader Robert Dole says he expects a vote tomorrow on his legislation that would limit the president's authority to send troops to Haiti. Mr. Clinton says the measure would infringe on his power as commander-in-chief. A Nigerian peacekeeper spoke today of how he was mistreated while held hostage by supporters of Mohamed Farah Aidid in Somalia. NPR's Michael Scola reports from Mogadishu.
Umar Shantali spent nearly a month in a dark room, often with his hand and leg chained together. He was kept naked and left to lie in his own waste. Aidid's supporters wrenched his foot, tearing ligaments in it to keep the UN peacekeeper from escaping. Shantali limped into a press conference here today to tell his story. He said his captors moved him into buildings near fighting between Aidid's militia and UN forces. They hoped, he said, he would be killed accidentally by UN weapons as a sort of lesson to show the brutality of the international peacekeepers. Shantali was released 4 days ago along with American pilot Michael Durant. Durant has not yet described his treatment at the hands of Aidid's supporters. This is Michael Scholar in Mogadishu.
Durant had minor surgery today to clean out a wound in his right leg and to treat damaged sinuses. He's due for a bigger operation to insert a metal rod in his fractured right thigh bone. It might require a blood transfusion. A base spokesman at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, says the second surgery will be postponed until doctors collect blood contributed by family members who have been screened for the AIDS virus. The spokesman says the family has some concern about the safety of the base supplies. This is NPR. A judge has ruled that Oklahoma may not execute a convicted double murderer until he has served his 20-year-to-life sentence in New York. He was convicted there first and then stood trial in Oklahoma. Oklahoma wanted to execute Thomas Grasso tonight, and he said he'd prefer death to the prison sentence. But New York authorities, led by Governor Mario Cuomo, insisted that the court send Grasso back to New York. Cuomo says the dispute has not been about the merits of capital punishment, although he himself opposes the death penalty. He says it's about enforcing an interstate agreement between New York and Oklahoma. Several doctors who say they're regularly harassed by anti-abortion protesters have appealed to the Attorney General and the FBI to investigate what they say is a growing wave of violence against doctors who perform abortions. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The doctors say Roe versus Wade means little if women are afraid to come to clinics and doctors feel unsafe working in them. Dr. Frank Snydell, who performs abortions at two clinics in Florida, says he's been the target of anti-abortion protesters for 4 years now.
I'm tired of getting photos of my parents as they are taken candidly shopping in a mall. I'm tired of having my tires filled with nails. I'm tired of wanted posters with my name, my family's name, my family's address, their phone numbers. I'm just tired of being terrorized.
In addition to getting the FBI and the Justice Department involved, the doctors want Congress to pass a bill that creates federal and civil penalties for blockading clinics. The measure has run into some opposition from lawmakers who say it limits freedom of expression. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
Defense Secretary Les Aspin says the quality of military recruits has rebounded after slipping in the first half of the year. Earlier, Aspin had said he was concerned that issues like gays in the military and women in combat had hurt recruiting. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Many of the stories in the new book, The Magic of Blood, are about construction workers because its author, Dagoberto Gilb, spent close to 15 years doing construction work. In a review of the book, poet Ray Gonzalez wrote, "The Magic of Blood adds another major name to Chicano fiction. Gilb's realism is the most lethal kind of fiction a Chicano can write. His stories of blue-collar workers are not just about the heartbreak of the working class, but about the strength, madness, and beauty its members possess as they hurtle through an existence too many people understand." Gilb grew up in Los Angeles. Gilb is the son of a white father and Mexican mother. After they divorced, Gilb stayed with his mother. He now lives in El Paso. This is a short reading from Churchgoers, one of his stories about construction workers.
None of us worked construction because we were rich, but neither did any let his body get this aching and exhausted and dirty only for the love of money. It was a need, and what we learned, physically and mentally, was that not just anybody could do it, not week after week, month after month, year in and out. Our job was our pride, who we were around our families and neighbors, what we spent in doctors and lawyers and dentists' office, what we carried camping and fishing into ball games, what we sat back with, tired, at the bar or in an easy chair facing the tube. It was the sex the women liked about us, the muscles our children admired. Employed, it was what we were never ashamed of.
Did you feel that way about your work?
Yes. Absolutely. I think that really sums up a lot. In fact, it's one of the little, I've decided to make this change in my life to sort of be a writer. And it's sort of the thing I'm constantly battling. Am I still? And sounds, I'm sorry if it sounds silly, and I'm sure I'll be accused of being overly macho for even saying this, but you know, I feel like I'm losing something. And I know, like, people, you know, I hang out with guys that, My son's in Little League and stuff, and I coach, and there's sort of this, you know, when they find out I'm a writer, they look at me and they wonder, well, you know, how do you say this? Well, like one guy is, "You're not a sissy, are you?" You know, it's silly, you know, but that's sort of the sort of working class Chicano mentality, and I have to sort of remind myself, no, I'm a writer, that's a good thing.
Well, when you were writing and doing construction work, would you tell the men that you worked with that you also wrote?
Never.
Why not?
First of all, I always had this sense that nobody believed me anyway, and then they think I was really weird. And then secondly, I just never wanted that to complicate anything.
So you didn't want them to read what you were writing, I guess?
Well, it wasn't, like, very accessible at the time, and, it was in these odd little magazines that nobody had ever heard of, And then, you know, it was just more or less, I really liked just being, one of the satisfactions I always got out of being a carpenter was it wasn't about what you said, it was just about what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And, some guy said, "Oh, go over there and build that wall." I just, you know, it wasn't about, you know, I'm the best wall builder or, you know, and this, it's just, you did it. And the evidence of how good a carpenter you were was whether you got the job done and in my case, often it was concrete. And did the wall hold? Did we get any bust outs, you know? Did any concrete leak? And, I always prided myself in being a good carpenter, and I sort of missed that satisfaction, to be honest.
Right.
You know? Right. I really missed that. And I missed just sort of being just this guy. And mm-hmm. That's really how I perceive myself, and I like that. Now, The other day I did a reading, and I don't like those sorts of things. I don't like to be the sort of, you know, on stage. I was literally on stage, and I don't like that. It's very uncomfortable, and I don't care for that. I really just like being just the, one of these guys that's going around, and I like hearing the stories that people tell, whether they're lies or not. Actually, I like lies just as much as I like truths.
When you were doing construction work, did that make it hard for you to pull out a pad during lunch hour? And
I never. What I really am is a journal writer. I write in my notebooks. I mean, I have literally maybe 3,000, at least 3,000 pages of notebooks. And I would write every night and sometimes in the morning. And that's what I would do. I would just record it in my mind, or anything that I saw or thought or heard. And I would just write it in my notebook, and that's basically where most of my stories come from. For instance, this church stories, comes from actually a literal story on a job site, and I'd written it out in another fashion, and it was just one of these stories that stayed, and I wanted to write it so bad.
Well, as one of the characters says in that story, you never know how crazy a person is until you try to lay him off.
Yeah, well, I think that's a real good thing in construction. I mean, it's people romanticize. But it's very hard work, and at least 3 out of every 4 jobs is awful. You're treated very poorly. You're screamed at. It's not just the physical work, which is, you know, it's tiring. There's a lot of stress. They're on schedules. There's a lot of men. There's a lot of big machines around you, and everybody's in a hurry. And a lot of foremen and superintendents don't have any patience, and they want it done. And you can go to a job, and the guy just won't like you. And he doesn't care, and he'll just, and that's it. And he won't like you, and you've got to work anyway. And there's an awful lot of men that, it's a struggle, it's a huge battle.
Did a lot of foremen assume that because they were the foreman and you were the worker, that they were smarter than you were?
Absolutely. One of my theories is that the stupider they are, the stupider they think you are. And it's really, when you get a stupid foreman, it's miserable.
So what was it like for you taking orders from a foreman who wasn't very bright, who assumed that they were much smarter than you when you were the one who was going home and writing?
Yeah, well, I usually the interesting thing is that I started believing I was as stupid as he thought. Isn't that how it works? You start feeling that stupid, And, you know, it seems, which is kind of my point, when somebody treats you stupid, you start doing stupid things, you make more mistakes, and things start happening that are bad. But as I do enough construction, I would sometimes wonder if I were really a writer or doing writing or what I was doing. My whole past would come to be called into question to me.
Do you ever wish that you were part of a big literary community instead of having spent most of your adult life as a carpenter working with construction workers?
No. I never did. In fact, every time I'd encounter it, I'd be so glad that, I don't even know how to explain it. I guess anybody that's been around it enough, it's just a lot of stuff that's going on that I don't care for.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fragile egos. When somebody gets mad at me, I expect them to yell at me.
And, right.
And I expect it. And if I do something wrong, I was going to say the wrong word. I screwed up, you know? I expect that, and this other stuff I can't take. Now, the only thing I did feel like I missed out on is sort of, I sort of felt like I was I'd published often in the Three Penny Review, and I'd be real proud. I think, my God, it's certainly the best magazine in the West, and it may be, one or two in the country as far as I'm concerned. And I'd publish in that, and I'd read the story, and I'd read the magazine for a few days, and I'd put it down, and there I was. I was back to being a carpenter, and as far as I knew, nobody else knew who the hell I was, man, or the story. I didn't, I had no feedback, and so I missed that sort of thing.
My guest is Dagoberto Gilb, author of a new collection of short stories called The Magic of Blood. We're after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you. Writer Dagoberto Gilb is my guest.
How did you get interested in reading and writing?
Well, I'm educated, and I love books. I just, actually, once I got out of college, I thought I wrote a novel. I wanted to be a writer. And I just picked up a writer's market and started reading about it, and I thought, well, you know, it says in here, and I don't know, this is whenever this, what is 1970s book I probably found in a used bookstore, and it said that writers made like $15,000 for their first book. So I thought, well, if I write one a year, that's enough money for me. So I wrote a novel, and I started writing a novel, and I do construction work, you know, and I thought, well, this is okay, I can handle this. But it didn't really work out so well.
Did you read much when you were young?
You know, no. I started reading when I was about 17 or 18. I read a book. Before that, I was interested in other things, you know, cars and girls.
Well, it's always interesting to me when somebody who doesn't read much when they're growing up ends up being a writer. I mean, what's the turning point there that
no
gets you interested in that?
I have no good explanation. I fell in love with books one day. I just, you know, I'm joking and I'm not, but it was like all I ever cared about were girls, right? And then one day I found books, and it was like there she was, and I sort of actually stayed with books for steadily, really hard for about 4 years. I couldn't get enough, you know. School, I grew up, you know, you go to parties and you know you look around and who's gonna try to kick my ass, you know. And when I got into college, I went to junior college, it was like there was none of that around. And it was like I couldn't believe how relieved I was to not have to always be thinking about stuff like that. And I just fell in love with the whole idea of education. I loved learning. Everything I heard in a class was absolutely news. And there wasn't a single subject that I didn't just love.
Did you read much Latino literature?
No, very little. The first Chicano I ever read was Rolando Hinojosa, and my wife, in fact, gave me this book, you know, years ago when she wasn't my wife, just a girlfriend. She gave me a book, and it was like, my God, look at this. And that was like the first time. It was about 1972, and or 72, 73, she gave me a book, and I couldn't believe it. I had been reading... well, you know, just the standards. Ken Kesey. I loved Ken Kesey. I think that sometimes A Great Notion is maybe one of the great American novels, right up there with Melville. I think it's just a classic. Who else? I hate to almost admit it because there's things about Jack Kerouac I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like, you know, he gets to sleep with a black girl and he writes a novel. It's sort of like, or he sleeps with a Mexican girl and he writes a novel. It would piss me off because that's sort of like, my mother would always get these kind of people, you know, the
who would see her as exotic?
Going out with the ethnic. And it used to just drive me nuts as a kid. I hated it. My mother married a guy, and, you know, actually a novel I'm going to work on next, and I just finished this last one, but this one I've been actually working on is about this sort of thing where my mother was this guy's Mexican gal, and I just hated it. I hated the whole experience. It was just the worst for me.
Does this seem to you like a decent time to be a writer? It often seems like much fewer people read fiction than used to before.
Well, you want to know what I guess my the bad me is speaking now.
Yeah.
I just think that a lot of stuff is so utterly boring that nobody should read it, and a lot of people read it and think that they don't like reading anymore, and they criticize themselves.
Mm-hmm.
For not reading, when in fact it's just so boring. Excuse that.
No, hey, I'm not offended.
Yeah, I really do believe that. And I guess here I am biting the hand that's currently feeding me a little bit. Sometimes I think it's this that a lot of people that are becoming writers are just, they're in school, and they never have gotten out, and they imagine stories. And one of the things I like to say is that, you know, Herman Melville really got on a boat. And it's not a metaphor. I mean, he really got on a boat, and he really did some whaling.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, I appreciate you asking me to talk with you.
Dagoberto Gilb's new collection of short stories is called The Magic of Blood. This is Fresh Air. Some of the verdicts have been handed down in the Reginald Denny beating trial. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what will you have on the trial on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have a story about the verdicts, including the fact that one of the defendants, Henry Watson, was found innocent of attempting to murder truck driver Reginald Denny. The jury, though, is still deadlocked on several charges, including the one against Damian Williams, that he attempted to murder Denny. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the Clinton administration's latest policies toward Haiti, freezing the assets of some Haitian leaders. And we'll be talking with Terry Carl of Stanford University about the history of U.S. policy toward Haiti. Those stories coming up later.
Thanks, Robert. That's on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. World music commentator Milo Miles likes to stay on top of new developments in pop, but he's just now catching up with what's been the hottest fashion in Mexico for several years, an eruption of good old rock and roll.
Vuelve luz y échale la luz.
Mention the term Mexican rock and roll, and you often get either a blank stare or a condescending snicker. Rock from south of the border has a rep for being shoddy and about a decade behind the times. In the 60s, Mexican bands played rockabilly. In the 70s, they played acid rock. In the 80s, they played disco. This inferior rep was always undeserved to a degree. The plain truth was that Mexican bands preserved styles that had declined up here. These Latino outfits stayed gutsy and hungry years after American style setters had gotten complacent or given up. Still, there's no denying that even the sharpest Mexican groups are often inconsistent and very, very derivative. Well, not anymore. The big changes in Mexican rock began in the late 1980s. To vastly oversimplify, the wide-open spirit of punk and new wave rock finally enabled Mexican bands to cultivate their own musical language as never before. There's a passel of rockers from down there now who can stand with any in this country, but three seem particularly on target to me. They're all boys, and we're going to skip the band histories to concentrate on sound. The first group is Maldita Vecindad. These guys stick closest to the classic rock, bad hombre mold. They rip off their shirts in concert. But there's a good dose of world-weary Velvet Underground sigh in them as well. They employ a horn section that can really pile the lines on top of each other and not sound like soul or salsa or ska. Maldita show a melting tenderness when they turn to flamenco guitar numbers, and they break into a mean, modified reggae at will. Here's a selection from their best album, El Circo, The Circus. Sobre un gran auto nuevo, poco de sangre roja, sobre un gran auto blanco, nada más bello, ni más lujoso, tan poderoso como un gran auto nuevo, y Junior lo admira y se imagina que su auto nuevo es un caballo blanco y él se siente un rey valiente, tan orgulloso que nada lo detiene. If Maldita are a little tongue-in-cheek when they play sentimental songs, the quartet known as Café Tacuba go whole hog for irony, which is, after all, the most addictive drug in modern rock. Their only American album is called Café Tacuba, and everything floats by in its mix: rap, classic rock, disco, reggae, mariachi choruses. Singer Juan has the bratty sneer of punk down cold. But one of the remarkable things about these postmodern satirists is that they play the passages of accordions and weeping guitars with enough expertise and passion to really subvert the corniness. And their song hooks have elan to burn. The new Mexican band with the plainest crossover potential, however, is Caifanes. Their album El Silencio would have made my top 20 in 1992 if I had heard it in time. Saul Hernandez is a triple threat band leader. He writes songs that are alternately hearty and mordant. He plays lead guitar in his own biting, terse idiom. And he flourishes a big, limber voice that can pet all the curves of a melody. His boldest swoop suggests a tenor Steve Winwood or David Bowie. And yeah, the dance rock of Caifanes recalls Bowie and U2 in equal measure. It's no surprise that longtime Bowie guitarist Adrian Belew produced El Silencio, giving it space and depth beyond other Mexican recordings. However, Bowie's band Tin Machine is just a rust bucket compared with ensemble work this joyous and a band as rich with speed, grace, and savvy variety as Caifanes.
Milo Miles is a writer and critic based in Boston. A new public radio listener has just entered the world. We congratulate our colleagues Barbara Bogave and Chris Spurgeon on the birth of their son, their greatest production yet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
As we await Game 3 of the World Series, we talk baseball on the next Fresh Air with NPR baseball commentator Bill Littlefield. He's written a new book called Baseball Days, From the Sandlots to the Show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.